Good morning. Here we are wrapping up this series. We've been in Daniel for so long. We did the first half before Christmas and now the second half on all the prophetic material, and today's the last of it. You know, I want to remember and remind all of us that we're just praying for blessings on our team that's in Israel right now. Pastor Frank and the team are in Jerusalem. And isn't it funny how after thousands of years, Jerusalem still seems to be the center of everything? Isn't that amazing? But it makes perfect sense in light of the passage that we're going to look at today, why that would be the case. So next week, my son and I, we're going to a conference in San Francisco, and he's going to be coming with me. He's 12 years old, so he gets to go on a trip with his dad. So you can imagine how exciting that is for him to get on a plane, and we're going to go somewhere and stay in a hotel. He's really excited. So we're packing suitcases that we can carry onto the plane, and I'm teaching him, you know, how you pack for a trip. That you have to think about, okay, where we're going. How cold is it going to be up in San Francisco compared to how it is here? It's not going to be the same weather up there. And you have to know what we're going to be doing in order to pack correctly. You need to know how many days we're going to be staying there, and if we're going out to dinner, the kind of places that we're going to be going, and the kind of things that we're going to be doing to spend our time, you know, if we're going to be running around or if we're going to mostly be indoors or outdoors. Because there's limited room in the suitcases. And there are rules about what you can even pack on them to take them on a plane. So you have to think ahead of time. You can't pack if you don't know where you're going or how you're traveling or how many days you're going to be there. You can't pack for that. Packing is a plan. It's a plan for a journey. And a journey, all journeys have a goal. There's a place that you're going to. Even talking about going on a journey but not knowing where you're going, that doesn't make any sense. It not only doesn't make any sense because you wouldn't know what to pack, but it makes no sense because you would never get there, right? If you didn't know where you're going, you're going to get somewhere, but you're not going to get to the place you're supposed to be. And this conference is at a specific place and a specific time. So we need to be there at that place. Now, the journey that we're going on makes sure that we'll be there on time and be ready for that conference. This is all really common sense. This is what I'm trying to teach them as we're packing. But since we're talking about something that's right in front of us, like a trip to San Francisco and getting on a plane right here at Orange County this next week, it's less likely we're going to make a mistake because it's close and it's familiar. Less likely we'll get lost, pack something that we shouldn't, or get on the wrong plane and or get there and think, why are we here? We forget. You know, that's not going to happen. But life is a journey also, and it's the most important journey that there is for us. The question is, where are we going, and are we packed and ready to get to that place? Because everyone has a destination where their life is headed, where it's going to end up. Some just don't end up in the place that they're supposed to. That's the reality. Some don't even know where they're going. They just sort of stumble along. Because unlike a trip to San Francisco, it's not right in front of us where we're going to end up. It's out there somewhere. It's a ways off your destination. And the younger you are, you know, the more dreamlike and intangible this idea of being with God in eternity. That's so out there. Because we have so many things right in front of us that occupy our thoughts and our dreams and our plans. It's not about a destination, though. It's also about how you travel to get to the destination, because you have to travel a certain way in order to reach it at all. And some young people just head in whatever direction in today's world with no real purpose or goal. They just sort of live in life day to day. And then they get older and they turn into us. And we might still not have our eyes on the destination when you get to this age. And if we've been so far off track for so long and wandering around that we've forgotten that there's a point to all this. There is a point to all of this. So we're doing a series on visions of the future. Visions of the future are a glimpse of the destination that we're heading toward. It's the end of all this, but it's not just the end of everything. It's the beginning of something else, but it's the end of our time here. And it's a path that leads to a destination. That destination is a destiny that you're heading toward. and the one who waits for you there. So prophecy, it's given to us to tell us something. Not so that we're going to be able to predict the future. That's not the purpose of prophecy. We may never live to see the future of the world. We're only going to be able to live to see our future in the place of that greater future. Prophecy is given to us so that we are pointed in the direction we should be heading, knowing how it's going to turn out in the end, so that we pack and prepare to be able to reach it and live our lives as we travel to that today. So when we get to Daniel 11 and 12, here, the last two chapters of the book, we reach the end of Daniel's visions of the future. We're going to go all the way up to the last verse. This week, I'm going to start with his prophecy of the future and then talk about what it means to our future. So the first section here is God's plan for the nations dominating Israel leading up to the first coming of Christ. Last time I spoke, I gave the practical, and then I got to the prophecy at the end, and we didn't even have time to cover the prophecy. So I'm going to start with the prophecy first this time. So let's actually go back to Daniel 10, verse 20, because this is the setup for chapter 11. And Daniel's talking to an angel here, and the angel says, "Do you know why I've come to you? Soon I will return to fight against the prince of Persia, and when I go, the prince of Greece will come. But first, I will tell you what is written in the book of truth." Okay, first, before I go, I will tell you what's written in the book of truth. Okay, that's what you want to hear about. That's chapter 11. This is what the angel tells him. It's written in the book of truth. That's God's plan for the future. And the picture of a book, because it's not a real book, right? But it's explained that way because a book is something where it's printed or written down. It's a writing. It's already written. It's not going to change. That's the picture. And it's the truth. That's what the angel is telling us. It's the future for Israel as it's caught in the grips of these nations that surround it, that fight against each other, one from the north and one from the south. They keep coming together and clashing, and Israel's always in the middle, which is exactly what we see in the world today. Same exact thing continues. Israel caught in the middle. So when the prophecy talks about the king of the north, we're going to look at some verses, you got to think he's talking about kingdoms to the north of Israel. And when he talks about like Syria or the Seleucid Empire, and when he's talking about the south, he's talking about kingdoms south of Israel like Egypt. And in particular, Egypt is one of the kingdoms that's mentioned in this prophecy. So this is a prophecy about Israel and the nations that basically fight against each other, and Israel's always in the middle. Now, I don't have a real big interest in ancient history, I'm going to tell you that, except to the degree that it's not ancient history and it's the future. And from Daniel's perspective, this is all the future. So that's fascinating. I mean, wouldn't you like to know what is going to happen in the world over the next couple of hundred years? Wouldn't that be interesting to you? I think that's fascinating. We know that this is future to Daniel because these manuscripts are dated centuries before the coming of Christ, before the events that we're reading about here actually happen. Now, there was a lot of skepticism about that because the prophecies are so powerful that at one point people said this must have been written after the fact because this lines up with history too perfectly. This can't be true. It has to be that somebody lived through this and then wrote this and sort of snuck it into the Old Testament later on. But at the Qumran discoveries, we find the Dead Sea Scrolls. The book of Daniel is a consistent part of the Old Testament. We have numerous manuscripts, and they're dated centuries earlier at an absolute minimum. So this skepticism was basically wiped out by that discovery. So I'm going to run through some verses and tell you a little history, but just enough to make a point. So let me first set the scene for you historically. So Daniel's living in the time of Cyrus, the king of Persia. And we know historically that after Cyrus, there were four Persian kings. We know that from history. The first is named Cambyses, which he ruled from 522 BC. We don't have any record of him in the Old Testament, but we know about that guy. Then after him came Pseudo-Smerdis, who reigned just for 1 year. And then after him came a very known king, Darius I, who reigned from 486 BC, and he's mentioned in the book of Ezra. So he's the third. And then after him came the most famous of all the Persian kings, who's Xerxes I. That's the king from the book of Esther. And he was a lot more powerful than all these other kings. He was wealthier and more powerful. He was sort of the peak of the Persian Empire and really the end of the Persian Empire in this time. So we know this historically. So now let's turn to Daniel 11, starting in verse 2, and read the beginning of this prophecy. Now then, I tell you the truth. Three more kings will arise in Persia, and then a fourth who will be far richer than all the others. When he has gained power by his wealth, he will stir up everyone against the kingdom of Greece. This is exactly what happened. These are the four kings, and we know that Xerxes, the fourth king, the king that's in the book of Esther, did lead an expedition, a military expedition against Greece. In fact, it had hundreds of thousands of people. He had hundreds of thousands of troops, and we know that that attack had a disastrous end against Greece. And because of that, really the power of Persia was broken, and it was sort of the end of the Persian Empire, really, after Xerxes. But this is exactly what we're reading about in this verse. So as I go, just leave these verses up as we're looking at them. Okay, so now let's go to the next verse, verse 3. Then a mighty king will arise who will rule with great power and do as he pleases. Well, we know historically what the great king was that appeared after Xerxes was defeated. That's Alexander the Great, who here, the prophecy says, a mighty king will arise who will rule with great power and do as he pleases. Alexander the Great, we know that guy died when he was young. He had an untimely death, and his vast empire was broken up and given to his four generals. We know that historically. And the four generals, it didn't go to his kids, it didn't go to his progeny, it was taken over by these four generals, that we know. Okay, so now let's read verse 4. After he has arisen, his empire will be broken up and parceled out toward the four winds of heaven. It will not go to his descendants, nor will it have the power he exercised, because his empire will be uprooted and given to others. This is a prophecy directly fulfilled historically. Then we know what happened after that is when his empire got broken up, one of his generals, Ptolemy I, ended up taking the section of the empire that is down in Egypt, and he went down there and ruled as the king of Egypt. But even stronger than Ptolemy was one of his associates, Seleucus Nicator, who ends up taking the area north of Israel, the Syrian Empire, which ultimately becomes the Seleucid Empire, which is a Greek-infused area, but it's Syria and all those countries, Afghanistan, Pakistan, up to the north. He was temporarily associated with Ptolemy, so they worked together for a while in battle, but his empire ultimately became more powerful than the empire to the south of Egypt. So here's verse 5. The king of the south will become strong, but one of his commanders will become even stronger than he and will rule his own kingdom with great power. Okay, fulfillment of that historically. So Ptolemy and Seleucus did become allies. We know that. They worked together and to oppose enemies. And then they had successors. So Ptolemy II was the successor to Ptolemy I. And then Seleucus Nicator, his successor, actually it was two successions later, was Antiochus II, who's known as Antiochus Theos. And they were forming an alliance together. And in 252 BC, Ptolemy's part of his alliance was he wanted Antiochus to marry his daughter. So they came up with this deal. The problem was that Antiochus already was married. So what he did is he put his wife aside to solidify this alliance with the south. He ends up marrying Ptolemy's daughter. So she ends up going up and ruling in the Seleucid Empire, and this sort of solidifies. But then something happens. Ptolemy dies. Ptolemy II, he dies. So Antiochus then divorces his daughter and takes back his original wife. Okay, we know this historically. He takes her back, but the problem is apparently she's really upset about how she's been treated, so she plots to murder her husband and has him murdered, and then she has Bernice, Ptolemy's daughter, murdered. We know this historically. So she didn't appreciate how she'd been treated. We know that. Okay, so here's what the prophecy says about these events in verse 6. After some years, they will become allies. The daughter of the king of the south will go to the king of the north to make an alliance, but she will not retain her power, and he and his power will not last. In those days she will be betrayed, together with her royal escort, and her father, and the one who supported her. Everything here actually happened in this couple of centuries after the time that Daniel lived. Everything you're reading. All the way down through verse 35, all these ideas and concepts and images actually relate to real historical events. There are 135 predictions in chapter 11 leading down to verse 35, and all of them were accurately fulfilled in history. We can line history up to match these events. It's so accurate. This is what caused so many secular researchers so much difficulty accepting Daniel at one point, until the Qumran discovery. But then when we get down to about verse 33, it seems like we're wrapping up the prophecy in this and describing the terrible times that have come on Israel under Antiochus Epiphanes. He's the last of the kings in Daniel's prophecy. This is the king Antiochus. So he's a descendant of the Seleucid Empire, the fourth, Antiochus the fourth, and they called him Antiochus Epiphanes. And he oppressed Israel, and then a group of Israelis opposed him, known as the Maccabees, and this leads to a massive persecution for Israel about 150 years before Jesus is born, and the events surrounding that are what the Jewish people celebrate at Hanukkah today. Okay, so this is he's the last king in the succession of this prophecy, going down to about verse 33. And then Daniel, the prophecy continues here, the angel speaking to Daniel. And he mentions the wise in this passage and in what's coming up. And the wise are the people that understand the prophecy. Those are the wise people who understand God's word, so that when they get to these events, they're not surprised by what's happening. They look and say, this is what we expect if God is really God. So that's why they're wise. So remember that as we're reading. Okay, verse 33. So we're skipping down through all these other kings that I don't have time to cover these guys. Those who are wise will instruct many, though for a time they will fall by the sword or be burned or captured or plundered. When they fall, they will receive a little help, and many who are not sincere will join them. Some of the wise will stumble, so that they may be refined, purified, and made spotless until the time of the end. For it will still come at the appointed time, the end. Okay, until the time of the end. All of a sudden, it's like we're skipped ahead from all these things that have happened in the past, but it's still future for Daniel. But it sort of like seems like we skip over now to the end, to the end of the age, and you'll see that as we're continuing to read. Now we're at the final end leading up to the return of Christ. So what is this thing that we just skipped? It's removed from the prophecy given to Daniel. The angel just skipped over something. And the key to understanding that is that this is a prophecy for Daniel's people. And the angel keeps repeating that. This is the story of Israel in the center of God's plan. In between these events, Antiochus, and these coming events, and the coming king who's like Antiochus, is the time of the church. Or what Paul says, the time of the Gentiles. This is a time where the gospel's going out into the world, and God's people are composed of all nations. Then when we get to these events that are coming up, that are still future in here, we're talking about events for the nation of Israel. And their future, not just for them, their future for us, starting in verse 36. And we're going to read about a king here who reminds us of Antiochus. Antiochus set up a false idol in the Jewish temple here as part of this revolt, which is one of the reasons that they revolted. He set up a false idol towards Zeus in the Jewish temple. What history refers to and scripture as the abomination of desolation. But Jesus in Matthew 24 prophesies of a coming abomination of desolation that is going to be committed at the end of time. That's the connection between the last of these evil kings and the king that Daniel is hearing about in verse 36, when God's attention is back on Israel. Okay, so God's plan for Israel during the final years leading to the second coming of Christ. Verse 36, the king will do as he pleases, He will exalt and magnify himself above every god and will say unheard of things against the God of gods. He will be successful until the time of wrath is completed, for what has been determined must take place. So this is the king leading up to the very end of time. This coming king, he's going to draw people's worship to himself. This is one of the characteristics we know about him. We also know about that from the book of Revelation, because the book of Revelation has a lot to say about this king, who is referred to in the book of Revelation as the Antichrist. We know that this person will speak against the God of Christianity and Judaism as a key part of his message to the world. We know that from Daniel's prophecy of the 77s back in Daniel 9, that the last 7 years of human history, Daniel's 70th 7, the last 3.5 years are the tribulation, the great persecution of Israel that happens, and there is a central point, the abomination of desolation. He will set up a false image to himself in the Jewish temple, and that will mark the central point in the last 7 years and the beginning of the last 3.5 years, which is what is referred to as the Great Tribulation. That event is what Jesus prophesies of in Matthew 24. So then in Daniel's prophecy, he describes a coming battle. It's a world war. It's the final war here in chapter 11, verse 40. At the time of the end, the king of the south will engage him in battle, and the king of the north will storm out against him with chariots and cavalry and a great fleet of ships. He will invade many countries and sweep through them like a flood, this Antichrist. He will invade many countries and sweep through them. This was never the case with Antiochus. None of this ever happened to him. This is a prophecy of the coming king and the final battle. And these are events in the first half of the last 7 years before Jesus returns. So this king, he faces north and south in battle. See, he's neither the king of the north or the king of the south, this coming king. His forces come from somewhere else entirely. Isn't that interesting? And the north and the south here, we don't know what kingdoms this is referring to. The north could be Russia. The south could be China. It's not explained to us. But we know from Revelation chapter 9, which seems to describe this same immense battle, we know from Revelation 9, John in his vision, he hears the heavenly host mention the number of troops who are involved in this war. And John in his vision says the number that he hears spoken is 10,000 times 10,000 troops, which is 100 million troops. That is an impossible number of troops in biblical times. Impossible. That's the population of this entire area. But today, 100 million troops is possible in light of the billions of people in world population, and especially over in that part of the world. Entirely possible. Okay, now chapter 12. Here's where the prophecy starts to wrap up. Verse 1. At that time, Michael, the great prince who protects your people, because this is a prophecy for Israel, who protects your people, will arise. There will be a time of distress, and the word distress is the word tribulation. There will be a time of distress such as not happened from the beginning of nations until then. But at that time, your people, everyone whose name is found written in the book, will be delivered. Multitudes who sleep in the dust of the earth will awake, some to everlasting life, others to shame and everlasting contempt. Those who are wise will shine like the brightness of the heavens, and those who lead many to righteousness like the stars forever and ever. But you, Daniel, don't worry about it. Roll up and seal the words of the scroll until the time of the end. Many will go here and there to increase knowledge, like us, just like we are. So this describes the end. The final end, the end to the persecution, the end to the evil, and ultimately to the resurrection of God's people. A time of intense persecution for the Jews, described in detail in the book of Revelation, outside the scope. Daniel gives us the framework, and Revelation gives us all the specifics about the kinds of things that are happening. But the church isn't mentioned here. And it's not mentioned in the book of Revelation either. Really, in the book of Revelation, the only time you see the church is in heaven. before the throne, which is why we may conclude that the church is gone for this time frame, that the church is taken from the earth by the great rapture that Paul writes about in 1 Thessalonians 5 before these events even begin. That's one of the reasons why we might think that that's the truth. But it's not spoken of in this prophecy. We don't know exactly. But it makes sense because when the church is gone, God's attention then could come back on Israel for the completion of Daniel's prophecy of the 70 weeks leading up to the end of the age. So down in verse 8, Daniel speaks for the first time here. I heard, but I did not understand. So I asked, my Lord, what will the outcome of all this be? He replied, go your way, Daniel, because the words are rolled up and sealed until the time of the end. Many will be purified, made spotless and refined, but the wicked will continue to be wicked. None of the wicked will understand, but those who are wise will understand. From the time that the daily sacrifice is abolished and the abomination that causes desolation is set up, there will be 1,290 days. Okay, 1,290 days is 3.5 years. Blessed is the one who waits for and reaches the end of the 1,335 days. 45 days after the end of the tribulation, something else happens. Maybe the return of Christ. So this is like a countdown, and this is the event that Jesus predicts in Matthew 24, the abomination of desolation set up in the temple. Verse 13, last verse. As for you, go your way till the end. You will rest, and then at the end of the days, you will rise to receive your allotted inheritance. In other words, you don't have to worry about any of this. This is in God's hands. When you read the predictions that have been fulfilled, and then you read the predictions of things that have not been fulfilled, you come to realize some things, and that's what I want to talk about. The first thing you come to realize is that God's plan is unfolding around us and can't be stopped. That's why we have this prophecy. It's written in the book of truth. Prophecy is allowing us to peek behind the scenes here for a reason. It's so that you understand, and we need to understand this, God's in control of human history. He's in control. The actions of the rich and powerful don't amount to anything in light of that. We live brief lives and are gone, just like these kings. They just, one after another, just passed away, swept away in time. But God's plan continues and contains all of this. And nothing can stop it. No power can alter it until the end is fulfilled. It's written in the book truth. So when we see things that are essential for this prophecy to become true, like, for instance, Israel becoming a nation back in 1948, that had to have happened for these events to occur at all that we're reading about as future events. If there's no nation of Israel, this prophecy wouldn't relate to anything. And imagine all the centuries that people would read this and think, this can't be talking about the future because the nation of Israel has been gone for 1,000 years. And now we have a nation of Israel again. And Jerusalem today, there's so much controversy, it's still at the center of everything. But that's exactly what we expect if God's word is true and it's written in the book of truth. But instead of focusing on what God's going to do in the world and through the end of time, we are tricked into thinking we should focus on the moment and what we can get for ourselves right now. That's the big trick, that the good life is right here, right now. It's not out there somewhere. And you can be happy if you just had more money or more control in your life, more power, more fame. If you just had that, you'd be happy, you know? Despite the fact that the people that paint that picture, Hollywood, they paint a picture like that. That you get to the results you want through moral compromise or superficial appearances or material wealth. And the people who spin the tale, just like these ancient kings, the Hollywood moguls, the superstars, their lives implode in scandals and addiction. And we just watch this happen around us and watch them fall one after another, just like the kings in Daniel's prophecy. So what can we learn as we read about these kings and think about God's plan? As they're crushed by armies and murdered some of these people, horrible, across the ages. And this is a good lesson for Hollywood, you know, right? To study this, and also for us. This is what we need to learn from these kings. First, that it's futile to invest your life in seeking riches and power. Doesn't Hollywood need to know that? That it's futile? They're temporary, these things. They run out. In the end, you have tragedy and disappointment. And it doesn't matter how much money you have or how many people you command in your army. No matter how much security you build for yourself, a day is coming where it will fall from your grasp. And nothing you can do can stop that. All you can do, if you're wise, because you know where it's all going, is to let it go now and grab onto something that can't fail and will never end. That's what God's offering us. A kingdom in which Jesus will reign forever. All these kings pass away, but there's the King of Kings, and we can grab onto him. And you're going to be with him if you do what Daniel did. Second thing we learn from the dead kings is that it's foolish to think you're in control of life. These guys thought they were in control. You know, I think I'm in control of all the mistakes here. I've made all these four mistakes. I was thinking about that and convicted as I'm studying this. The one I've made the most is probably this one. The sense that I can do this on my own. I got this covered. You know, I don't need you, God. I've worked this all out. I've got my plan and I can make it happen. I can get what I want. And this thought, it's foolishness because it keeps me from relying on God and getting his strength and power in my life. When I try to do it myself and think I can do it, I miss on the amazing thing that God actually is willing to do in revealing his power. And some of us, you know, we bury ourselves in things that don't matter, in our careers, in our hobbies, you know, Netflix, whatever. We bury ourselves in it. And we don't look for something great for God to do in our life. We don't look to love the people that God put in our life. They become an annoyance to us, a distraction from the things that are important to us. And it was the same with these kings. They had great plans, these kings, and they're all dust now, every one of them. But God's plan and his power are still happening in the world. Third thing we learn from the dead kings, it is short-sighted to think God isn't at work or that evil is winning. You know, life is hard. It's full of difficult things in life, and things go bad sometimes for us in life. We hit a really bad point, and it's tempting to think, you know, God, hey, where are you right now? Why aren't you helping me? Do you even care what I'm going through right now? And I've been in this spot in my life where I'm thinking, God's not even in this. He's disappeared. And everything's out of control. And we can walk away from God at those times if we think, you know, God isn't here for me when I need him the most. But if you do, you miss the chance to see his plan and what it's trying to do in our lives, where it's trying to take us, what's going to happen next. You miss that. Beyond your heartache and your disappointment, where is this all going, God? What's next in your plan? Because his plan takes horrible and evil things and weaves them together to produce victory in our lives, just like he's ultimately taking all this evil and violence and weaving it together for a final victory for righteousness in the world. And it's more wonderful because it overcomes evil in the end. So his love triumphs if we keep our eyes fixed on him and where we're going, and on the kind of people he wants us to be. And it's really hard in today's world. But this is where we're heading. If we're wise, we read the prophecy, and we keep our eyes fixed on the promises and his fulfillment of them that is still ahead for us. Fourth thing we learn from the dead kings is it's prideful to think you're not accountable for how you live your life. I mean, isn't this just the biggest statement about our culture today? And you know, when we're young, I mean, just to be fair, we think we have a lot of time anyway. And we have the freedom to do whatever we want. And this is a big buzzword in our culture today, which is choice. You know, my ability to choose for me and decide what's right for me. This is a huge thing in culture today. It's more the case than ever before. But if you follow Daniel's prophecy, one day all of this is going to be weighed and evaluated and judged by the King of Kings. Jesus says in John 5 that all judgment has been given to him by the Father. He has all authority. The day we stand before God, it's Jesus we're standing before, Jesus himself. We are not the final word on what's right. He's the word on what's right. And if we're on course for that moment and thinking about it and picturing that moment when we're going to stand before him, our priorities become clear and we realize who we are and we make decisions that are good in his eyes, unlike these kings. Okay, so that was the first lesson of prophecy. The second big lesson of prophecy is your days are numbered, but your life is woven into God's sovereign plan. So one of the things we learn from the lives of these kings and from just prophecy in general is life is short. King after king dies. This life isn't all there is. It's temporary. Some people use that, though, as an excuse to not do anything at all. Let's just party. Let's just have fun. We're running out of time. You know, let's just milk the days just to have as much fun as we can. But if you do that, you're just throwing your life away. You're just passing time by. That's what we learn. Your time on earth matters, and you can spend it on something that lasts because you know where it's all going, so you know what to invest your life in. God's plan, it's like this great tapestry. You know, it's like this great tapestry with so many threads in it, and there are twists and turns in these patterns, but it all links together with a perfect symmetry, including your life, because you're woven into that plan. The kings, they had their plans, and they all passed away. But Daniel played a part in God's plan. That's the plan that ultimately becomes fulfilled. His life, Daniel's life, speaks to us today when all these great kings are forgotten. You don't know any of these guys, probably. They're all gone. But you know Daniel because of how he lived his life. And your life can speak also in the context of eternity and in the heavenlies, as the angels and God look down on the work of their servants in the world today. Just by being the person God created you to be and not the person the world tells you to be, the person Hollywood tells you you should be. Forget that. See, this is Daniel's secret. He doesn't care what anyone thinks except God. Okay, third, the darkness of this world, pain, suffering, and injustice is coming to an end. That's another thing we learn from prophecy if we focus our eyes on this. It tells us that in the end, there's going to be no more evil, that God's going to have victory and he's going to get rid of it. That's important to remember because destroying evil isn't something you have to worry about. It's something the Avengers have to worry about. It's not something you have to worry about, right? Like, you don't have to. God's got that under control. Nothing can stop it. Evil cannot win. As bad as things are, and as bad as they get in a world that has so much pain and evil in it, like the one we live in, you don't have to be afraid. You don't have to panic. You don't have to worry about, how am I going to stop all this? You're not going to stop it. Sometimes we get angry when we read about certain public events, and we think, I can't control this. I don't know how to fix this. Or something happens in our lives, we're treated badly, or someone betrays us, and we think, this is so unfair. I can't do anything about this. Or we see corrupt people prosper and good people suffer in the world. We get angry, or we get afraid, or we get discouraged. But the prophecy tells us we don't have to worry. God's got this. It's all part of his plan. And things are going to get worse before they get better. So when we see things getting bad, we think, this is what we expect. That's okay. Because when they can't get any worse, based on this prophecy, we know that's when Jesus comes back. So I pray, you know, because things are looking pretty bad. Jesus, come back. It's bad. But your job isn't to solve all that or worry about it or get mad. Your focus is to be faithful. That's all you have to do. Be the person he made you to be. His child, as you travel on this journey to that moment when you're going to be standing with him. That's all you have to do. And that's the final point. Point four. Your job is to go the way he has shown you until the end, when he will keep every promise he made to you, just as he did to Daniel. Verse 13, let's read that one more time. As for you, go your way till the end. You will rest, and then at the end of the days, you will rise to receive your allotted inheritance. That's God's message to you also. In other words, you keep up what you're doing, Daniel, honoring God, putting him first, relying on God, seeking him in your decisions, trusting him in the lion's den, walking in the fire and not being afraid because you know he's with you, leaning on his power. Follow him no matter what anybody thinks or the threats that are put on your life or whatever it costs you. Follow him. That was Daniel's job in his life, and he did it. That's the life he lived. That's the story that we've been following. That's your job. That's the path. That's how you reach the destination where you're supposed to be heading. It leads to the same result as we have here for Daniel, the inheritance that Jesus has promised you. He said, I am making many places for you in my Father's house. There are many mansions, he says. See, he's promised it to you. You're heading to that moment and all the things that Jesus has beyond this life. But we let the world distract us. You know, we let cares and concerns, financial problems, disappointment distract us. Or maybe we think, you know, God can't do anything through my life. I totally messed up in my life. God can't do anything great through my life. And there's so much in front of us, you know, so many things that distract us, the day-to-day, things that the world tells us to go after, day-to-day life. It's so vivid, you know, the things I'm struggling with, that guy who cut me off on the freeway, or my job interview coming up, or a salary review. The day I stand with Jesus seems so far away, so remote and dreamlike. But don't be fooled, because we're all on course for that moment. And when you're there, standing in front of him, it's all of this that will seem like the dream. Nothing will be more real than that moment. So we have a prophecy so that we'll fix our eyes on the end. That's why we have this, that we will be wise and not the things that distract us, the concerns of the moment, because life is a journey. And all journeys have a destination. You have a destiny that you're heading toward. Every day is a chance to take a step in a direction to the moment that you're with Jesus Christ. So live today in light of that coming moment. That's what we're told. Live today, continue the way that you're living, follow him until that moment that you're with him. And as you do, the Lord walks with you and works through you and guides you. You're not alone. He guides you to the moment when you're with him face to face and never leaves you. Let me pray. More than anyone in the Bible, Lord, I just think I'm struck by this man's life and by the amazing power that you showed through his life, Lord, and I want that for my life. And we all, Lord, want to see you do powerful and miraculous things in our lives. Put our feet on this same path, Jesus, the path that you walked, the path that took you into glory, Lord, the path that we're following that'll bring us back together with you in that moment. Jesus, give us strength and give us wisdom, Lord, to not get distracted by the images and deceptions of this life, but to focus on that moment when we're with you and know what really matters and make decisions that just bring us closer to the destination and the destiny you plan for us. Jesus, thank you for this and the series, Lord. Use this in our lives as we continue to follow you as a church body. In your name, amen.